Welcome to Well-Versed, where we bring biblical principles of governance to governmental leaders and you. This is the Well-Versed podcast.
Hi, friends. This is part one of part two of the Bevelin Beatty interview with Dr. Jim Garlow. We hope you enjoy listening and be sure to stay tuned for part two.
Okay, we welcome you to today's edition of Well-Versed podcast. I cannot tell you how excited and honored I am to introduce you to Bevelin Beatty. Now, I suppose a few months ago, you wouldn't have known that name, but now almost all of you know that name because a video of her went viral. I mean, really viral. It so blessed me. I watched it over and over and over. I sent that so many people, and everybody else was sending it to each other. It inspired and encouraged us all. And I've got the hero, the courageous one on the phone right now, this podcast. Bevelin, I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to connect with you now. Now, you and I had the privilege of meeting in person unexpectedly. What was it, 3 weeks ago?
Yes.
Yeah, and
I wish I had my book with me when I met you so you could sign it, but we're gonna do it on the September 27th.
What's funny is I said to my wife, when they said Bevelin Beatty, I said, oh, she's somewhere here. Where is she? I said, that's my hero. I want to go meet her. Then you stood up and you actually said, Jim Garlow, you're my hero. I've got your books. Well, I ain't no hero, but you made my day when you said you're reading my books. That meant a lot.
Yes.
Yes. Bevelin, thank you for being on with us. Tell me, where were you born and raised? Where'd you come from?
Well, I was born in Staten Island, New York, and I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina when I was 3. And that's because my dad was on the run for murder. So we had moved down south.
Your dad was what?
On the run for murder.
Oh, my.
Bless yes. You. So we got moved down south, ended up being raised there until college time. I went back to New York. I lived in Staten Island for a bit with my dad, and then I moved to Brooklyn. I lived there for maybe 3 years. And then I moved up to Maine for 4 years. And I believe that was my wilderness time with the Lord because I grew so much and learned so much about him because it was so still. And then a year before my dad passed away, I moved back to New York. And, you know, especially with his passing was a big step in my life because I was walking in faith and basically trying to show my dad the walk of Christ. He accepted Christ in his last days, which was such a miracle and a blessing. And once he passed away, I just felt like I had nothing to lose and I was going to go full force, guns blazing, and serving the Lord.
Now, he only passed away less than a year ago, right?
Yeah.
So you're still in that tender phase of healing. I just pray blessing on you for that. I can see in your countenance right now as we're looking at each other on the screen, I can see that this is a tender place in your life. You have quite a few brothers and sisters, right?
Yeah, 10 of us in total, 5 from my mom's side, and then 10 with my dad and his different women. We're pretty close for the most part. And me and my sister are the 2 oldest.
How'd you come to faith in Christ? Where along the journey?
Well, I was sitting in jail for 7 days, waiting on my dad to bail me out. I had did a money.
Do I dare ask why you were in jail?
Yes, money laundering scheme.
Okay.
So I had laundered like 20, 30 grand. And my dad didn't know anything about this. So when he found out I was in jail, he was like, oh my God, I got to get my daughter out of jail. I had been hanging with the wrong crowd. I was heavy into the gay community. I was not gay, but I hung with the LGBTQ community heavy. And they were just into, you know, scamming and money and dancing and partying and drinking and smoking. And this had stemmed from me going to school for fashion marketing and merchandising. And that
was
industry
that part of school.
It was at Art Institute of New York City.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, yeah. Very prestigious institution. So you were in the party scene while you were there.
Yes.
And continue.
I got with the gay community a lot, and we just did the most, too much. And so I ended up getting arrested, and my dad was bailing me out, and while I was waiting on him to bail me out, I met a woman who told me about a night I had cried out to the Lord for help because I was dealing with severe depression, severe. But you know, the way I was raised, you don't let people know about stuff like that. You know what I mean? You kind of, you never let them see you sweat, kind of try to keep your countenance in a sense of fleshly sense. But for the most part, internally, I was dying inside. And so one night I came home drunk from drinking with my friends at the bar. I went into the restroom. My roommate was sleeping in his room. I turned on the water and I just started to cry. I laid on the floor and I cried out to the Lord. And I really didn't even know I was crying out to him, but I felt hopeless. And when I met that woman, she told me about that night. And when she told me about that night, I knew the Lord was speaking to me. So this was a prophetic word that the Lord used to get my attention. And from there, I just listened. And she told me, if you do not surrender to Christ and change your life, you're headed to death. And for me, I knew it was God. And I was like, Lord, I do not want to die. And she also told me that you know better. So you're going to get it the worst. I knew Jesus was Lord. I never questioned that. He came to me multiple times in my life and it showed his hand in my life. I just focused on myself more than God. So finally, in that moment, I surrendered my life to Christ. And it's been an uphill growing since.
What year was that?
This was 2013.
My goodness. I got to tell you, you operate with such maturity. You have grown remarkably. That's only a 7-year span. I stand in awe of you. I mean, I'm telling you, that's remarkable growth. You articulate clear maturity in Christ. I would have no idea you're only 7 years old in the Lord. I'm going to jump us from there right to how all of us became familiar with you. That was, what was the date you went into New York City?
I think it was May 31st.
May 31st. Now, when you went in, just so everybody knows kind of an overview, paint a picture of what happened, and then I'm going to back up and ask some specifics on that particular event.
So we rode in, and me and the crew, I was with two other ladies in Edna,
who are when you say the crew, are these ladies involved with you with ministry, just good friends or?
Yes. So basically they are women that either volunteer to join us or that we've discipled them. So a young girl named Jessette Duran, we met at the gym and the Lord kind of introduced me and it made to her and we discipled her.
Is that, the one who's always with you? Is a little bit of a diamonds and silk feel to it. The way you dialogue is so incredible.
No, that's Edna. That's Edna. She's the one who mentored me. So Edme discipled me, the one with the dreads, that's Edme.
Yeah, yeah.
She discipled me. And then I discipled Jessette. And then we met Susan at an abortion clinic and she just loved how radical we were. And she was just like, listen, I'm rolling with you guys.
You were out there you were out there saving babies at the abortion clinic.
Saving babies, 100%, yeah, yeah. 100%, and tearing the devil down left and right. So,
if I believed in cloning, I would clone you. Okay.
Hey, listen, I clone me too, so I can get some more people out to join me so we can get this thing going.
Oh, man, you are so right. Okay, so you're going in on May 31. You and a team of two other ladies in New York City. Now, when you open the video clip I saw, it looks like you had quite a few cans of paint, but only one got used. Am I correct?
Only three got used, but check this. We put in an order, right, for 28 cans of paint. When we go to the Home Depot, only three cans are available. Now, we done spent $1,000 on this stuff, so we like, yo, where's our paint? But they only had three cans of paint available, and somehow, some way, they were able to go back into stock and get the paint. And now that me and Ed may look at it, we're like, wow, God set aside three cans of paint, and we only used three cans of paint.
Okay, so you got there. Now, as you went in there, you had to know something was going to happen. You weren't just going to paint the streets of New York City and ride out of town, right?
No, we actually went up to the police precinct before we did it. And we met a woman while we were walking up there to the precinct. A lot of the police officers were complimenting our shirts, Jesus Matters. So they were like, oh, I love that shirt. Where can I get that shirt at? And so after giving them my information, I let them know, you know, we want to speak to the chief because we want to let them know what's going down. We were going to tell the police before we did it what we were going to do, whether they liked it or not. And we wanted to let them know that we were going to stand with them and fight for them. So she led us up to the front. And when we told her first what was going to happen, and she was like, I don't think you should tell my chief, but this is what will happen. When you get there, we'll try to turn as much of a blind eye as possible. And we'll see what, you know, we'll make sure that you guys are okay. We'll make sure that you're all right. So we said, okay, thank you, Lord. So then actually that officer before meeting, she said, you know, I was on the phone with my mother and I was praying with my mom and we were asking the Lord, where were the Christians at? With all of this stuff that's going on, where are the Christians?
This is a police officer saying that.
A cop.
Oh my goodness.
Praying on the phone with her mother asking, where are the Christians? Oh. And so when she met us, she believed the Lord had literally just answered her prayer right then and there. And we told her, you know, real Christians are going to rise up. We're going to fight with you. We're going to stand for you. Stay tuned. Right. So we finally get out there. And of course, you guys catch everything else on camera. Before we actually start the painting, we go to each officer. We let them know we're with you. We're going to fight with you and we're going to support you, whether you like it or not. And finally, we went to grab that paint and everything else was history.
And so when you got the paint, it's not like you painted with a brush. You painted with your hands and knees, right?
Yes.
So moving, watching that.
I wasn't expecting to do that. So, you know, you see a lot of people doing it now, copying. But listen, you got to do it naturally. You got to come in the spirit or else it just looks bootleg, okay? So what happened is we dropped the paint and they're about to arrest me. So to keep them from arresting me, I drop on the floor.
Yes.
And I'm using my hands now to spread it to kind of give them a hard time arresting me because it's slippery. So it was all just to keep from getting arrested and to kind of get it done longer. I had no knee pads. My knees are still healing. My nails, I still got a little bit of black paint. You can't see it too much in my nails, but I was not expecting to get my nails messed up or black paint all over my legs. That was not planned. Okay. But we had to do it.
And if I saw the video correctly, it looks like an officer who went to arrest you actually fell into the paint. Did I see that right?
He did. He bust his butt. Oh, Lord, he did. He fell so hard. I was like, oh, God. But the other cops knew it was an accident, so they held me down because I easily could have got charged with something for that. But they made sure I was okay, and they just kept it at criminal mischief. He took a work comp.
You weren't touching him. He just fell. It was too slippery, I suppose, I would guess.
But he wanted to. I'm going to tell you why he was so happy with it. Because right now, even being a police officer, if you breathe the wrong way, you might end up in jail. You could go from protecting people and sending criminals to jail to being a criminal sitting in jail yourself, because that's how New York has it set up. So for him personally, he needed to make money and he knew being on the job was risky. So he actually was grateful that he fell and could take workers' comp and leave because it's too hot in the kitchen that these cops don't even want to be there. They're just basically they're waiting their time out to find a way out because it could cost them their freedom.
Oh, my. That's a whole nother topic, and I won't go down that road. At least we won't go down that road yet, but that's painful to hear, and we know that's reality. So you, they actually let you, I say let you, I don't know, they couldn't stop you. You continued. What was amazing, you were crying out, Jesus matters, take our cities back. I think you said Black Lives Matter doesn't care about blacks. I believe that's what you were. Was I hearing you correctly?
You were correct. That's what I said.
You went for a really an extended period. It seemed to me a long time. And they did not arrest you during that whole time. Was it because they weren't sure? They didn't want to get paint all over themselves. Was that a factor?
That was a factor. They have to pay for their own uniforms out of their pocket. So a lot of them do not want to. These uniforms cost $400 or $500. So that played a humongous part in them not wanting to get on that floor and get messy.
You went for, I would say, for several minutes, correct?
I was able to get down there for like a good 3 or 4, maybe 5 minutes.
It was a long time. Then they finally stand you up and lock your hands behind your back, correct?
Yes.
And then you're taken in and arrested. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, when you're all covered with paint, this is a logistics question. Do they put you in the squad? I mean, in the police car, all covered with paint?
They put us in the police car. They had someone sit next to me just to make sure that I was okay. And as soon as we get to the police station, they get me some alcohol and start helping me try to get the paint off and give me some water to cool off. I mean, they were so good to me. They were so good to me.
Wow.
They were so good to me.
Oh, I'm just pausing for a moment to let that sink in. These police officers were highly empathetic to what you were doing and what you're standing for.
Yeah, 100%. They felt it. They knew. These cops, they knew and they feel and they understand the sense of urgency that I have, because in the same way, they see what's happening. They're watching it, New York crumble before their very eyes and people die left and right. So they knew this was important and it had to be done. And they respected that.
Just a couple going thing back to when you mentioned just a couple personal things. When you talked about being in front of the abortion clinics and you went to the police, in this case, you went to the police department first. You would not have known about my past. I was the liaison between Operation Rescue and the police department. I was living in Dallas at the time, Dallas-Fort Worth area. And so we would meet with the tactical unit of the Dallas Police Department each Thursday before a Saturday Operation Rescue event. We wouldn't tell them where we're going to go. But then I wasn't one who was arrested, but I was allowed to be an observer and stand 3 feet away from every arrest representing Operation Rescue in those events, trying to close down the 12 killing centers, abortuaries of Dallas and Fort Worth, 9 of them on the Dallas side and 3 of them, I think, on the Fort Worth side. So we were heavily involved in that. And then you also would not know, we have a ministry in New York City as well as Washington, D.C. New York City's at the United Nations, meeting with ambassadors and then a Bible study in the UN for the employees. And New York City is such a wonderful, glorious, and attractive city in so many respects, but it's lost all of its glamour. It's just lost so much. People who used to want to go don't want to go, and people want out. So I'm glad this you're here to say that the police are clearly aware and empathetic to what you were saying, because the current mayor is destroying what Giuliani restored back there. I was on the East Coast when Giuliani made the city safe, and we were shocked at how safe it became, and now it's turned into what it is. Well, let's pick up with your story. Now you're in the police car, you're taken, they took good care of you at the jail, are you actually incarcerated overnight, or how long were you kept in there?
Well, we were kept in there for maybe 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours. We got desk appearance tickets, and as soon as we got out, we went to Harlem to paint that mural, and then we went to Brooklyn to paint that mural as well. So not too long.
Paint the mural. Bring me up to speed on that. I'm not aware of what you're talking about.
We threw paint on the mural in Harlem, and then we threw paint on the mural in Brooklyn as well.
The Black Lives Matter?
Yes, he made sure that they had Black Lives Matter murals in each borough. So it was one in Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, and Harlem, one in Brooklyn, one in Staten Island, I think one in Queens as well. And so we made sure to try to hit those two. Now, the thing is, we did that because we knew, and I'm not going to say how we knew, but we knew after we left that precinct that there would be no police guarding it. He only keeps the police guarding the one in front of Trump Towers, but the rest of them he leaves be.
So you were allowed to paint over Black Lives Matter up in Harlem?
Yep, Harlem and in Brooklyn. But we still we got backlash from bystanders because the Black people there were offended. They were offended at the fact that we were painting over the mural Black Lives Matter. So the war wasn't even with the police at this point, nor was it ever, but it was now with the people, the Black people, because they felt like, why would you paint over that mural? You're Black. Why would you paint over that? And so for me, it was mind boggling because they felt such a need to, mind you, when we pulled up, they're sitting on the corner, drinking, smoking, listening to music, doing absolutely nothing productive or progressive. But the fact that that mural was there, they felt like this was special and important and we have to protect it. So didn't matter that the neighborhoods are terrible. Didn't matter that the apartments that they go back to sleep in are roach infested and the elevators are piss infested. But the fact that the mayor would just paint Black Lives Matter on his street that would be driven over eventually, that made them feel special. And they were willing to fight for that. But we still were able to get some paint on them.
And did the people around and stop you?
No, they couldn't stop us. One of them actually in Brooklyn took or grabbed Ed May's roller stick and grabbed it. But by that point, I had seen what he did. And so my roller stick turned into a baseball bat. And I was like holding it this way. And I said, if you come near me, don't come near me. And the guy was like, I'm not going to come near you. But I mean, these men are not just like regular kumbaya guys. These are guys that have been drinking, smoking, aggressive thugs. So at this point, I had to make sure that I addressed them assertively to let them know, don't come near me and don't touch anything. And the power of the Lord came through. The authority stood by and those men didn't lay one finger on us. They did throw some stuff at my car. And I think they didn't bust the window, but they scratched up a bit of my car. So I had to get a new car. But for the most part, we were fine. The Lord protected us.
And then you went to from the one in Harlem to Brooklyn?
Yeah.
And what happened there?
That's what happened there with the men grabbing us. And that's what happened.
But in Harlem, I thought you were describing Harlem originally. So it was it the same at both places of people?
Both places, the same. In Harlem, it was a lesbian woman who attacked us and tried to throw a paint can at us, and the empty one, and was just like, you're black. You shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be rolling over this, and you're black. And so she was a little aggressive, but, you know, we kept painting. And then we rolled out. So it was more so drive-by painting, just trying to get the paint over it to make a statement. And actually, we actually got to get more dialogue in Brooklyn than we did in Harlem, because we told them, how are you supporting something that wants to see your demise? They hate black men. They hate you. And so for a second, they kind of were hearing us, but they were like, oh, no, this isn't the way. This isn't the way. And, you know, we just easily had to drop some paint and get out of there.
And we all distinguish, and we didn't take time to do this on this particular podcast. All lives matter. Black lives do matter. The organization Black Lives Matter is where the problem is. Yes. You want to say a word about what is, why would you paint over a phrase Black Lives Matter? There's a reason you're doing that. What is that reason? What is Black Lives Matter as an organization?
So let me break down the core of this thing. So I was just watching downstairs a documentary about Jim Jones. Okay, Jim Jones pushed this narrative of Christian socialism. He pushed kumbaya, let's just move away and love each other and live in a place of euphoria and just live together happily ever after. Jim Jones was demonically possessed, and people didn't realize until it was too late to get out. And by that time, 914 people were slaughtered. Okay, because of this manipulation that this man did. That same Kool-Aid is being offered with BLM. Now, I'm going to tell people something that they may not agree with, but they can look it up. The three founders of BLM, not only are they lesbians and feminists, which some people say, oh, that doesn't matter. Your lifestyle matters. If you want to be a leader and you want to speak up about something, a person's lifestyle is going to reflect what they stand upon, period, right? These women worship spirits. They worship dead ancestral spirits in Africa. They deny God and they hate God, okay? And they believe in worshiping their own. So these women will go to places where people were unjustly murdered by white cops, and they will pour laminations and they will seance. And in a sense, other people will get emotional about the phrase Black Lives Matter and another black person dying, and then they will demonically destroy the city. Now, this is the thing. While they're pushing this narrative on one end, the people, our people more than ever, are dying on another. New York defunded the police by $1 billion, and de Blasio took that money. He stole that money. Now, crime is up 200%. Black people especially are dying the most because our communities are the most violent. We take up 11% now. Used to be 12, used to be 13, but we're declining thanks to abortion. We take up 11% of the population, yet 50 85% of violent crime. So when you take the police out of our communities, you're basically saying, let them kill themselves. On top of that, they don't support the nuclear family. They don't support a man being the leader of the family and a woman being the helpmate in the children. Therefore, you don't support Black men, because a man is not a man until he's a leader in his own household. All right? You support abortion. The number one killer of Black people is abortion. So you support the genocide of Black people. And then if they're not killing each other, shooting in jail because they don't have daddies, or they're not daddies, they're dying in the womb. And if they're not dying in the womb, you want the boy to turn into a girl or the girl to turn into a boy, and total perversion against the Lord. So every single thing that BLM stands for is setting us up for failure. On top of that, they also support white supremacy. Why so? Because they only will burn down cities and burn down businesses and push for laws to change when a white cop kills a Black man or a white person kills a Black man. But they will never address the Black-on-Black crime issues that we are dealing with in our own cities. That's white supremacy in itself.
Not to mention, maybe you covered this and I didn't catch it, that they are, by their own declaration, Marxist.
Marxist, yes.
They said, we are trained Marxist. People say they don't have an ideological frame, and they say, we do have an ideological frame.
Yes.
Their exact words in their interview, homosexual affirming, LGBTQ affirming, trans affirming, that's one of their 13 core principles, and they're blatantly anti-Semitic, openly anti-Semitic, have made trips to Israel to meet with the enemies of Israel, and came back and declared who they were on Shavuot, or Passover, we as Christians call it. They defaced a number of synagogues in Los Angeles. And the list continues of what they just continue to do. So thank you for outlining so clearly, Bevelin. Your articulation skills are remarkable in nailing the real core issues here. Let me move us. I want to move on to Chicago. What happened just literally a couple of days ago? But is there anything I'm missing in New York? We're going to kind of leave New York here in a moment.
No, you're missing anything.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please read the show notes for additional details if you would like a copy of the book or resources mentioned. Remember that Well-Versed is a 501c3 tax-deductible nonprofit organization. We rely on your support and partnership.
Thank you for listening to the Well-Versed podcast. For more information, please go to www.wellversedworld.org.